Open the brackets, it's time for All Squared.
Hello and welcome to All Squared number 7. In this podcast, Christian talks to mathemagician Colm Mulcahy about his new book and about maths magic. And we also talk about maths at the British Science Festival.
Hello, Colm. How are you?
Hello, Christian. Fine, thanks. How are things in England?
Certainly fine. So Colm has recently released a book about card magic called Mathematical Card Magic, 52 New Effects. It's through CRC Press. Can you tell us what it's about, Colm?
Well, like the title says, it's organized into 13 chapters on mathematical card magic. Each chapter has four tricks, so to speak, and they're kind of arranged by team. So, you know, chapter 6 is about the Gilbert Shuffle and stuff like that. And chapter 12, which is the Queen chapter, is about error-correcting codes and their application to mathematical magic. So there's 4 times 13, 52 overall. There's a few extra freebies thrown in for good measure.
So what prompted you to write this book?
Interesting question. I had never really thought about writing a mathematical book before. And I got into this back in 99 or so. In fact, I was at a winter meeting of the big math societies here in the States. And I ran into a chap called Paul Zorn, who's a well-known mathematician. He was most recently the president of the Mathematical Association of America, the NAA. And over a beer, he said to me, "Are you aware of this amazing card trick using 5 cards?" And I didn't know what he was talking about. So he started telling me about it, and the trick is as follows. You have two people who are mathematicians or mathematicians. They're in cahoots. They've agreed in advance on a communication system that's purely mathematical, so there's no body language, no physical cues, no verbal cues. One of them is given 5 cards, any 5 cards from a standard deck of 52. He or she looks at them, quickly hands one back to the audience member, and displays the other 4 in a row from the right. They could be telephoned or emailed. In fact, it was conceived as a telephone trick back in the late 1940s. So the other mathematician sees 4 of the 5 cards only and is promptly able to name the hidden 5th card. And it really does work, no matter what 5 cards you get your hands on. It's known as the Fitch-Cheney trick, named after a quite well-known mathematician who was also a keen magician, and he invented it and used to perform it with his son back in the late 40s and into the 50s, and it was published in a very obscure place in 1950, and I think Martin Gardner was one of the first people to notice it, and he mentioned it a few times in some of his books, but he never gave the details. In any case, Paul said to me, "Do you want to know how to do it?" And I said, no, let me think about it. So there's one or two parts that are pretty obvious. We can discuss those if you like. And there's one part that's not so obvious. So it actually took me 3.5 days to crack it. I was back at base camp in Atlanta when I cracked it, and I was very happy to have solved it myself. Then it kind of got me interested in going back and looking at other mathematical card tricks. And of course, I dug out all my old Martin Gardner books, which I'd read as a teenager and had kind of forgotten, to be honest, and discovered there was tons of other cool stuff. So it launched me on a path which has led me to this book, I guess.
So I want to stick with this trick before going back to talking about the book, because it sparked my interest. So should we talk about how you do it, or would that be ruining something?
Sure, we can talk about some of it. Yeah.
My first guess is to think about how many different ways there are of ordering 4 cards.
That's certainly relevant.
Right. And there's a natural beginning order, which is ascending value. Right. So I'll wave my hands from that point on, say you just associate permutations with cards or something.
You certainly do. If you had 4 cards, 4 different cards from a deck, you can arrange them. You can put 4 in the first position, 3 in the next, 2 in the next, and you have the last one to use. So it's 4 factorial, which is 24 ways to display those 4 cards. There are 52 cards in the deck, and it's not one of the 4 you can see, so it's one of 48 that you can't see. So you're off by a factor of 2. You need a bit of information if you try that approach. But there probably is a way to do it that way, but I find another way to think about it is go back and say, what's special? Is there one thing for sure that you can say about any 5 cards from a standard deck, given the way a deck is decomposed?
There's got to be a double suit.
It's got to be a suit match. That's it. The pigeonhole principle guarantees a suit match. That's, you know, the kind of standard entry point, and if you lock into that, you can make progress. pretty quickly. Maybe not all the way, but you get maybe two-thirds of the way pretty quickly.
Okay. So rather than sit and think about that, I think we'll leave that as a challenge for me and for the listeners.
Okay. Well, if they solve that one, here's an extra twist on it. The first twist on variation on that I really came up with was to have some of the cards displayed face down instead of face up, which on the surface seems to reveal less information. However, rather amazingly, you can do the following trick. Given any four cards, and of course it doesn't have to be a super match with four cards, given any four cards in the standard deck, it is possible to glance at them, hand one back, and display the other three for your accomplice magician. Three cards on display, some of them might be face down. As a matter of fact, all of them might be face down.
Mm-hmm.
And incredibly, in every case, you can tell what the hidden card is, the fourth card. And that was the first one I came up with, so I call that the oldest trick in the book, and it's actually the last trick in the book.
Hmm.
It's the very last trick in the book. And it's a little tricky to perform because there's some mental gymnastics. It's significantly harder than the five-card Fitch Cheney. I call it Fitch for Glory, or Fitch for Glory, but it's kind of a four-card Fitch Cheney.
So what was your background before getting into card magic? Were you interested in other kinds of magic?
No, not really. To be honest, I my degree was in algebra, kind of an abstract theory of quadratic forms or higher-level forms, you know, commutative ring stuff, very different from anything to do with magic.
Yeah.
And over the years, I dabbled in other things. I got interested in geometry, computer-aided geometric design, which uses splines and so on to approximate curves and surfaces. And then stumbled on wavelets, which have an interesting and fairly easy to explain application to image compression. So I spent a little time on that. And then somehow, like I said, I just over a beer, this came up. And within a year, I was quite obsessed with this. In fact, it's funny, we holidayed in Hawaii, I think about a year or two later. And at 2 a.m, there was a fire alarm. It turned out to be a false alarm, but the alarm was going off and they were saying, leave the building and leave by the stairs. So we went down 35 flights of stone stairs in our bare feet. And when we got to the bottom, you know, the kids were small at the time. My wife said to me, did you remember your wallet? And I said, no, but it's okay. I've got a deck of cards. Because at that point in my life, I just always had a deck of cards with me. So that if I ever had some downtime, and I knew when I was leaving a hotel at 2 a.m, I was going to have locked out for a few hours, that I would be able to, you know, play around and maybe stumble on something. So
that's certainly something I can sympathize with, or I can relate to, because our mutual friend David Cushing has always got at least one deck of cards in him, but usually a few more hidden around his person.
Yep.
It seems to just take you over, this mathematical card match. He's always
thinking. It's extraordinary how much entertainment, you know, you can certainly get for yourself, and if you're lucky, maybe generate for other people with a deck of cards. I mean, the 52 of them, they can be arranged in a rather large number of ways, 52 factorial. It's larger than more or less the number of elementary particles in the universe, so don't try writing them down. You won't have time or paper to do so. But there's just so many varieties of things you can do. I never played bridge, never played cards as a kid, but I wasn't ever particularly interested in cards. But the mathematical possibilities are perhaps not endless, but probably enough to keep me amused for another few decades.
So do you still keep up with your serious maths research while you've been doing this card magic stuff?
Not in recent years, no. I haven't been, some of the stuff I've done has taken me into areas of combinatorics and so on, and, you know, some little theorems have been proved. They're not earth-shattering or of great significance, I think, outside of the realm where I use them. But I've corresponded with, you know, people like Ron Graham and Percy Diaconis, who are, you know, very profound mathematicians who also happen to be pretty good magicians and have their own wonderful book, which I highly recommend. And, you know, in correspondence, stuff comes up that seems to be new, but I don't think it's particularly deep.
Okay. So back to the book. I've got 13 chapters with 4 tricks in each, and they're all new, are they? They haven't been published.
Some of them have been published on the web, but
they're
almost all original to me. I think chapter 9 has 2 that I used that are kind of overlap with original material developed many years ago, probably 50 years ago, by Ron Graham, Percy Diaconis, and Ron Vo. But almost everything else is something I've come up with in the last 14 years.
at all.
I try to stay away, to be honest, from a lot of cliches. I try to stay away from the three piles, you know.
Yeah.
Which card your pile is in, because that's been beaten to death ad nauseum, and it's the most hated trick among mathematicians, that's the most hated trick among magicians. Ironically, it's still quite popular with the general public, but it just induces a yawn
in
people who do magic or mathematics. And I also stayed away from casting out nines and, you know, stuff that's been just very well known and probably nothing particularly exciting in there. I tried to find things that were a little less obvious, even to a mathematical audience.
Yeah. So is it, would you describe it as a popular maths book, or it's got new stuff in it? It seems to be, just cover the whole range of ability
right.
and interest.
Well, it's aimed at the general public, and it's aimed at a more general public than the bi-monthly column that I do online for the Mathematical Association of America,
mm-hmm.
Which is called Card Column, a pun on my name. That, there's probably about 70%, 75%, I would say, overlap in material between the book and the combined columns. They've been running for 9 years now, so I guess there's 9 times 6, 54 of those. I use mathematical language freely in the card columns. I try to tone it down, if not exclude it. So you won't find a word like linear combination. It used to be in early versions of the book, but I took it out to make it more understandable to, you know, somebody who mm-hmm. doesn't have much mathematical sophistication, but is intelligent and interested. So it's aimed at a more general public. You know, the big words of mathematics have been concealed for the most part.
Are you seeking to inspire people to look at maths more, or is it just the magic?
Well, I think, you know, a young person looking at this might say, gee, I didn't know you could use math to do something entertaining, and, you know, I can amuse my friends with this, or my parents, or my family, or whatever, my teachers. So I think, you know, maybe it will turn some young people on to some new possibilities in mathematics, a fairly general audience. But each chapter ends with a section called Parting Thoughts, which has some deeper questions and occasionally strays into the use of, you know, more sophisticated math. Those little sections at the end called Parting Thoughts have, I think, make it clear that it's not just trivial, that there are other things to explore. And, you know, if somebody, I think it's also possibly useful for a first year seminar at university level, or maybe even a capstone seminar if you go into math in more detail, or as an independent study, as a guide, as a resource for independent study. Where I teach at Spelman College in Atlanta, we have a lot of students doing the mathematics majors doing independent study, and, you know, it has the potential for use there if somebody wanted to learn about province stats, because it's an application to that, or combinatorics or error correcting codes. Mm-hmm. In fact, the error correcting codes chapter grew out of an idea that a colleague of mine, Jeff Amy, had. He was doing independent study with some students about 10 years ago, and he was trying to motivate Hamming codes. And he thought, well, why don't I do it with cards? Instead of having zeros and ones, I'll have black and red cards, and we'll put out a display of black and red cards, and they'll be consistent because the last three cards will code the first four cards, and then I'll have somebody change one of the cards for a card of a different color. And the goal then is to figure out, if you hadn't seen the display before, which card was changed. And of course, it's just a Hamming error code issue. But I thought it was a very innovative use of Hamming codes. Now, the Hamming codes in question, of course, are a little bigger than the general public would relish, so I brought it down to a smaller one and took out most of those big words. But it still works nicely as a demonstration of mathematical magic.
Hmm. So we should talk about the elephant in the room here, which is that David and I have got a trick in this book.
Well, yes. There is, as I said in chapter, I think I said chapter 9, but it's actually in chapter 10, there are two tricks relating to De Bruijn sequences, which I first saw performed a trick in that style about 15 years ago, I would say, before I got interested in mathematical magic, maybe in the mid-90s, by Percy Diaconis. And he gave an extraordinary talk where he did this trick, and of course it blew everybody away. And this was one of the talks that he would not let people videotape, or, you know, he didn't want the secret out, but it was explained to those who were present. Now, he was keeping it for his book, which came out, the book he wrote with Ron Graham came out 2 years ago, and it's a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Magical Mathematics, published by Princeton University Press. And I had got permission from him to publish on the web a very simplified version of it with a much smaller number of cards. He uses powers of two for the deck size. So he actually used 32 cards, and I think he used slightly thicker ones so people didn't notice that it wasn't a full deck.
All right.
I made it easier by using, I can't remember, 8 or 16 and just cheating and using cards from multiple decks. So I think I had 16 cards, and I used identical cards in three decks, so 3 16s and 48. It looks like a full deck.
Right.
But actually doing it for 52, a number that's not a power of two, is a little trickier. They have a solution hinted at, and I can't remember if it's totally explicit in their book, and I didn't want to put that in my book because, you know, it's original to them.
Mm-hmm.
But I was delighted when David Cushing and yourself came up with this video, which was blogged about in the A periodical.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, maybe we could put that in instead. So we put it in as a kind of an addendum to the simpler version of the trick for people who wanted to see the full Monty.
Yeah. So someone, when we put that video out, someone wrote a comment alluding to this other way of doing it with 52 cards, or saying that they'd seen it was possible. Someone, that Diaconis had said it's possible, but not what the method is. So I guess we're probably quite far off the mark, because our solution doesn't feel very elegant to me.
But it works.
It works, I suppose.
You know, some things can be polished further. I have sometimes had people make similar comments. I've had people email and say, well, I like your trick, but here's a better way to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's good. If people are thinking about it and streamlining it, that's great.
Yeah. Well, like all maths gets streamlined down.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's actually a very important message to convey to young people again. And it's not one that the curriculum tends to convey, because the maths we teach tends to be highly polished. And, you know, depending on what generation you're in, you might have grown up or gone to university where it was strictly, you know, definition, example, theorem, repeat the cycle ad nauseum. That is nothing remotely like the way almost any mathematician in the world has ever developed mathematics, with the possible exception of Dieudonné or somebody. But, you know, math is discovered by bashing your head off the wall until it hurts. And eventually something comes together, and, you know, there's a lot of failure along the way,
mm-hmm.
nothing to be ashamed of. And sometimes a year after you've published something, you realize you got it backwards and it should be expressed more elegantly or better or more clearly or perhaps differently. And it gets refined, and it's only the highly refined, polished version that the students see. I mean, if we were to watch, you know, a composer composing, it would be painful, because it would probably be very slow. We listen to the polished work, or we see the finished piece of art, or the finished, you know, piece of literature. We admire that. I think in mathematics, we make the mistake of kind of hiding that from students, that the creative process is organic, fraught with mistakes, depression, anxiety, fear of failure. And yet, occasionally, some gem shines, and you can sit back and say, that was worth doing.
Yeah. Well, you've said exactly what I would always like to say on this subject, I think. It's odd when you meet people that don't want to publish unfinished work, or work that's not polished, or they don't want even anyone to see it. Because I don't know, you're never going to get there where it's at a point where there are no errors.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah. I put out a video a while ago of David had told me some fact about Fibonacci sequence. If you draw the Fibonacci numbers in a square and you take the determinant of a 2x2 square inside that, you always get the same number, which is a cool fact. So I just sat down and I thought, right, I'm going to prove this, and just recorded myself working it out on a blackboard. And I made a load of errors along the way. And a few people left comments saying it's really good to see someone getting stuff wrong and having to think for a bit. And
right.
Nobody ever, you don't really get shown that in a maths lesson because there's no time.
Well, I just made some comments suggesting that we might teach mathematics differently, but I know why we teach it the way we do. Time,
yeah.
Time, the pressure to deliver content. We just feel that we don't have the time, but we might need to find some way somewhere in the curriculum. You know, it's kind of interesting, mathematics, because the issue I mentioned, I think, is an issue in most parts of the world, most education systems, that students graduate with bachelor's degrees really having little, if any, concept of how mathematics is created, which would certainly not be the case in art or music or literature. But also, they, you know, imagine if you were an English, you know, your field of studies concentration was English literature or music or art, and somebody said to you, can you name a famous piece of work from the last 20 years, or a famous writer, or a famous painter, or a famous composer from the last 20 years, you would have an answer. I think we graduate mathematics students who would have difficulty answering that if you even change the number to 50 years.
Mm.
And I understand why. Again, we have to teach, you know, you have to start the basics and work up, and you'd barely get into the 20th century in mathematics by the time you get to third or fourth year in university. But maybe we should pause and, you know, stop and smell the roses every so often and tell students about conjectures, some of which are very easy to express, the twin prime conjecture, the Goldbach conjecture. There's been recent work on those. It's been incredibly exciting work in the last two or three years. people need to know that mathematics is a living, dynamic human endeavor. So easy to think of it as just old and ancient and somebody went to do a Greek code.
Yeah. So to get back to card magic, that's probably a nice way to get into the mode of mathematical research. I think you said before how when you try and work out how a card trick works, you'll sit there and bash your head against it for a long time.
That's true.
So is there anything in the book that you're particularly proud of?
I think the Fitzcheney four card trick.
That does sound impressive.
It's kind of surprising.
Yeah.
Actually, a year ago, we came up with a three card version. It didn't make it into the book, but it will be published in Math Horizons, which is an undergraduate mathematics magazine published by the MAA here in the States. It'll be published there probably in the spring. But it's almost entirely above board. It works very easily with a 48-card deck. It's a little trickier for a larger deck. But for a 48-card deck, the idea would be that three cards are handed to you. You display those three cards with one, two, or three of them face down, and the last face-down card is identified by your confederate, your accomplice, based on what he or she sees. And again, I don't think we can do any better than that. I don't think we'll get it down to two cards, but three cards. But it was a little too fresh to put in the book, and the last chapter was pretty tight, so I just let it go. Yeah. But there are, if you were to ask me what are card column's greatest hits, I would say the four tricks stand out that I have personally, essentially invented. Mm-hmm. One would be the opening trick of the book, which is sometimes manifests itself as an ice cream flavor spelling trick. I say, what's your favorite ice cream flavor? And meanwhile, I've got some cards in my hand. Maybe I have about a dozen cards in my hand. 11, 12, 13, it doesn't actually matter. So I'm shuffling the cards and I'm saying, what's your favorite ice cream flavor? And I'm relying on you saying vanilla, strawberry, or chocolate, because almost everybody does. If you say something very long, I'll need more cards. If you say something very short, I'll need fewer cards. The mathematics behind it is the following. The length of the word I'm spelling out, for vanilla it's 7 letters, for chocolate it's 9, for strawberry it's 10. That number has to be doubled. So you have 7 to 14, or 9 to 18, or 10 to 20, and the number of cards in your hand must lie between those two bounds. So 11 or 12 is safe for all of those flavors. I mix the cards up, and then I spell out the ice cream flavor. And I do that by spelling out, counting out the table. So I have maybe 12 cards in my hand. If you say vanilla, I take the top card, put it on the table, put the second card on top of that, until I have 7 cards down. So I spell out V-A-N-I-L-L-A. I have reversed the order of those 7 cards. I then drop the rest on top as a single unit, and I say, the first 7 was your ice cream scoop, whatever's left, and I don't need to know exactly what it is, it's the topping. And we do that 3 times over. So I pick up the pack, and I again deal out, counting out, spelling out, reversing the order, 7 cards, drop the rest on top. I do it the third time. Amazingly, I know what the top card is. And the way I do this in performance usually is to say to the person helping me, I want you to press down hard on the top card and turn it into, and I act like I'm being very casual. I say, I don't know, the three of spades. Of course, I know it's the three of spades all along.
Hmm.
And there's obviously some mathematics involved there. I told you one of the two secrets. One of the secrets is that the number of cards in your hand has to be between the length of the ice cream flavor, spelling, and twice the length. I can tell you the other secret if you wish, or you can find it on the web. It was actually the very first card column that was published in honor of Martin Gardner's 90th birthday, and that was published back in October 2004. So that trick, anyway, is a very nice and surprising mathematical principle. It is chapter 1. Further versions of that principle are explored. And in the last year, I actually discovered what I call a non-symmetric version of it, an asymmetric version, which ended up generating an entire other chapter, chapter 5. And then just this spring, I ended up finding a far-reaching generalization, which ended up generating an entire new chapter, chapter 9. So there's actually 3 chapters in the book which derive from that discovery, and that's a discovery I made in the spring of 2003 when I was living in Madrid. So the ice cream spelling trick, I think, is very nice. Another one is a trick where I shuffle the cards and I say, pick any 2 cards, add up the numbers, tell me what the numbers add up to. So if you got a jack, which is 11, and an ace, which is 1, you would say 12. Whatever number you tell me, I actually know what your 2 cards are. Now, clearly there's something a little more going on than I told you, but it really is based on mathematics, and it's based on a very interesting and surprising fact about a well-known part of mathematics, which I didn't know until I was actually teaching a class using a new book a few years ago, and I thought, boy, I can get a card trick out of this. And I did. And the third one, I think, is a popular one with the troops, is a poker-type trick where I hand you the deck and I say, shuffle. And it really is completely shuffled. We take off the top 10 cards, I peek at them, and then I say to you, which ones do you want, which ones do I get? You make all the choices. I always end up with a winning poker hand.
Yeah, I've seen that one. It's very impressive.
it takes a while surprising. To work it. It's actually based on probability.
Yeah.
The probability and something else. The probability part is the fact that, it actually ties in with the famous Berkeley paradox. If you have 60 people in a room and they're randomly picked, there's a very high probability, over 99%, that two of them will share a birthday.
Mm-hmm.
That seems very counterintuitive because it's 365 different days of the year. Similarly, if you have 10 cards from a shuffle deck, there's a very high probability that there's something of interest for a poker player. I'm referring to at least a pair of matching values, a pair of aces, a pair of twos, whatever. So actually it happens 98% of the time. So 98% of the time with 10 random cards, when I peek at them, I'm going to see at least one pair. You'd be surprised how often you see two pairs, or a pair and three of a kind, or even four pairs. In any case, I know where the pairs are, and even though I'm giving you three choices, because of the second mathematical principle, which was invented by a man called Bill Simon back in 1964, it's possible for you to make all the decisions, and yet I get the winning cards. I can also let you get the winning cards if we wish. I think those are probably the ones that I find myself doing most often.
Yeah.
In fact, I have a book signing coming up in a few hours here in Atlanta, and those are the four that I'm going to be doing, because it takes about 20 minutes to perform those. Give some little explanation, and they seem to be, popular and get people's attention.
Yeah.
And they're different. They're quite diverse.
It's occurred to me that I don't know whether it's unusual that you're so open with explaining how these tricks work.
Well, mathematicians are trained to teach.
Yeah.
And share. And, when you learn something new mathematically, and we see when I learn something new mathematically, I want to shout it from the rooftops. And thanks to Twitter, I can do that now. Maybe some people are listening, but you can affect it on your students, your friends, if you have friends who like that kind of stuff. So magicians, on the other hand, tend to be a fairly secretive bunch. And I have discovered in my, time interacting with magicians that some of them are extremely secretive. So there is this kind of dichotomy, which camp am I in? And the bottom line is, I'm not exposing other people's secrets.
Mm.
I'm sharing my secrets. And I'm happy to share my secrets because I think, they have some mathematical interest and they're entertaining, and if it gets people interested in mathematics. I haven't told you all the secrets of all the tricks, but I've given you enough, hopefully, to whet your appetite. And
yeah.
If listeners are interested, almost everything that I've mentioned is already freely available on the web at the Mathematical Association of America website, which is maa.org. If you look at card column there, you'll find all four tricks that I highlighted are all there. But there's lots of other stuff, and I think it's organized a little better in the book.
Hmm. So conversely, when you said that Percy Diaconis showed off the, or whatever that trick that was, but didn't want anyone to record it, that sounded a bit odd to me, that a mathematician would do that.
Well, it was interesting. It was part of a sequence of three lectures that he gave at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia, which is about 70 miles east of Atlanta. They have this prestigious lecture series, and he gave three lectures on very different topics, and the first two were videotaped, and they were on abstruse mathematical topics, but they were very good. And the third one, it was strictly no cameras, no videotape. And at the time, I didn't understand. But with hindsight, I do, because he hadn't published his book yet.
Mm.
The book that he wrote was Long Graham, and he really wanted that to be one of the highlights of the book. And it wasn't entirely his trick. I think Ron Ball, who is another magician who invented a lot of great mathematical magic back in the 60s and so on, I think he was part of the equation. So they just wanted to save it for the book, and that's fine. I understand now.
That's all for part one of the podcast. As a mathematician, I apologise, but we're going to leave the bracket open and close it in the next half of the podcast. See you then.